and that was when I saw he was crazy. It would have driven me crazy, too, living with that thing. Lewis was feeling sick to his stomach. He had drunk too much beer too fast. Pretty soon it was all going to come up on him. The heavy, loaded feeling in his stomach told him it would be coming up soon. Well, there wasn't much else we could do. We got ready to go. Hannibal says, "Bill, God help you." Bill says, "God never helped me. I helped myself." That was when Timmy walked over to us. He even walked wrong, Lewis. He walked like an old, old man. He'd put one foot high up and then bring it down and then kind of shuffle and then lift the other one. It was like watching a crab walk. His hands dangled down by his legs, and when he got close enough, you could see red marks across his face on the slant, like pimples or little burns. I reckon that's where the Kraut machine gun got him. Must have damn near blowed his head off. And he stank of the grave. It was a black smell, like everything inside him was just lying there, spoiled. I saw Alan Purinton put a hand up to cover his nose and mouth. The stench was just awful. He almost expected to see grave maggots squirming around in his hair. "Stop," Lewis said hoarsely. "I've heard enough." "You ain't," Judd said. He spoke with haggard earnestness. "That's it. You ain't. And I can't even make it as bad as it was. Nobody could understand how bad it was unless they was there. He was dead, Lewis. But he was alive, too. And he knew things."
"Knew things?" Lewis sat forward.
"Yeah." He looked at Alan for a long time, kind of grinning. You could see his teeth, anyway. And then he spoke in this low voice. You felt like you had to strain forward to hear it. It sounded like he had gravel down in his tubes.
"Your wife is fucking that man she works with down at the drugstore, Purinton. What do you think of that? She screams when she comes. What do you think of that?"
Alan, he kind of gasped, and you could see it hit him. Alan's in a nursing home up in Gardner now, or was the last I heard. He must be pushing 90. Back when all this happened, he was 40 or so, and there had been some talk around about his second wife. She was his second cousin, and she had come to live with Alan and Alan's first wife, Lucy, just before the war. Well, Lucy died, and a year and a half later, Alan up and married this girl. Laureen, her name was. She was no more than 24 when they married. And there had been some talk about her, you know. If you were a man, you might have called her ways sort of free and easy and let her go at that. But the women thought she might be loose. And maybe Alan had a few thoughts in that direction, too, because he says, "Shut up. Shut up or I'll knock you down. Whatever you are." "Shush now, Timmy," Bill says. And he looks worse than ever, you know, like maybe he's gonna puke or faint dead away, or do both. "You shush, Timmy." But Timmy didn't take no notice. He looks around at George Anderson, and he says,
"That grandson you set such a store by is just waiting for you to die, old man. The money is all he wants. The money he thinks you got socked away in your lockbox at the Bangor Eastern Bank. That's why he makes up to you, but behind your back he makes fun of you. Him and his sister. Old wooden leg, that's what they call you," Timmy says. And Lewis, his voice, it changed. It got mean. It sounded like the way that grandson of George's would have sounded if, you know, if the things Timmy was saying was true. "Old wooden leg," Timmy says. "And won't they shit when they find out you're poor as a church mouse because you lost it all in 1938? Won't they shit, George? Won't they just shit?" George, he backed away then, and his wooden leg buckled under him, and he fell back on Bill's porch and upset his pitcher of beer. And he was as white as your undershirt, Lewis. Bill, he gets back on his feet somehow,
and he's roaring at his boy, "Timmy, you stop it! You stop it!" But Timmy wouldn't. He said something bad about Hannibal, and then he said something bad about me, too. And by then he was raving, I'd say. Yeah, he was raving, all right, screaming. And we started to back away, and then we started to run, dragging George along the best we could by the arms, because he'd gotten the straps and harnesses on the fake leg twisted somehow, and it was all off to one side with the shoe turned around backward and dragging on the grass. The last I seen of Timmy Baderman, he was on the back lawn by the clothesline, his face all red in the setting sun, those marks standing out on his face, his hair all crazy and dusty somehow. And he was laughing and screeching over and over again.
"Old wooden leg, old wooden leg, and the cuckold, and the whoremaster. Goodbye, gentlemen, goodbye, goodbye."
And then he laughed, but it was screaming, really. Something inside him, screaming, and screaming, and screaming. Judd stopped. His chest moved up and down rapidly. "Judd," Lewis said, "the thing this Timmy Baderman told you, was it true?"
"It was true," Judd muttered.
"Christ, it was true.
I used to go to a whorehouse in Bangor betimes. Nothing many a man hasn't done, although I suppose there are plenty that walk the straight and narrow. I just would get the urge, the compulsion maybe, to sink it into strange flesh now and then, or pay some woman to do the things a man can't bring himself to ask his wife to do. Men keep their gardens too, Lewis. It wasn't a terrible thing what I'd done, and all of that has been behind me for the last 8 or 9 years, and Norma would not have left me if she had known. But something in her would have died forever. Something dear and sweet." Judd's eyes were red and swollen and bleary.
The tears of the old are singularly unlovely, Lewis thought. But when Judd groped across the table for Lewis's hand, Lewis took it firmly.
"He told us only the bad," he said after a moment. "Only the bad. God knows there is enough of that in any human being's life, isn't there?"
2 or 3 days later, Lorraine Purinton left Ludlow for good, and folks in town who saw her before she got on the train said she was sprouting 2 shiners and had cotton stuffed up both bores of a pump. Alan, he would never talk about it. George died in 1950, and if he left anything to that grandson and granddaughter of his, I never heard about it. Hannibal got kicked out of office because of something that was just like what Timmy Baderman accused him of. I won't tell you exactly what it was. You don't need to know. But misappropriation of town funds for his own use comes close enough to cover it, I reckon. There was even talk of trying him on embezzlement charges, but it never came to much. Losing the post was enough punishment for him anyway. His whole life was playing the big cheese.
But there was good in those men, too. That's what I mean. That's what folks always find it so hard to remember.
It was Hannibal got the fund started for the Eastern General Hospital right before the war. Alan Purinton was one of the most generous, open-handed men I ever knew. And old George Anderson only wanted to go on running the post office forever.
It was only the bad it wanted to talk about, though. It was only the bad it wanted us to remember, because it was bad, and because it knew we meant danger for it. The Timmy Baderman that went off to fight the war was a nice, ordinary kid, Lewis, maybe a little dull but good-hearted. The thing we saw that night, looking up into that red sun, that was a monster. Maybe it was a zombie, or a Dybbuk, or a demon. Maybe there's no name for such a thing as that. But the Micmacs would have known what it was, name or no.
"What?" Lewis said numbly.
"Something that had been touched by the wendigo," Judd said evenly. He took a deep breath, held it for a moment, let it out, and looked at his watch. "Well a day. The hour's late, Lewis. I talk 9 times as much as I meant to."
"I doubt that," Lewis said. You've been very eloquent. Tell me how it came out.
There was a fire at the Bateman place 2 nights later, Judd said. The house burned flat. Alan Purinton said there was no doubt about the fire being set. Range oil had been splashed from one end of that little house to the other. You could smell the reek of it for 3 days after the fire was out.
So they both burned up.
Oh, yeah, they burned. But they was dead beforehand. Timmy was shot twice in the chest with a pistol Bill Bateman kept handy, an old Colt's. They found it in Bill's hand. What he'd done, or so it looked like, was to kill his boy, lay him on the bed, and then spill out that range oil. Then he sat down in his easy chair by the radio, flicked a match, and ate the barrel of that Colt 45.
Jesus, Lewis said.
They were pretty well charred, but the county medical examiner said it looked to him like Timmy Bateman had been dead 2 or 3 weeks.
Silence. Ticking out.
Judd got up.
I wasn't exaggerating when I said I might have killed your boy, Lewis, or had a hand in it. The Micmacs knew that place, but that doesn't necessarily mean they made it what it was. The Micmacs weren't always here. They came maybe from Canada, maybe from Russia, maybe from Asia way back in the beginning. They stayed here in Maine for 1,000 years, or maybe it was 2,000. It's hard to tell because they did not leave their mark deep on the land. And now they are gone again. Same way we'll be gone someday. Although I guess our mark will go deeper, for better or worse. But the place will stay, no matter who's here, Lewis. It isn't as though someone owned it and could take its secret when they moved on. It's an evil, curdled place, and I had no business taking you up there to bury that cat. I know that now. It has a power you'll beware of, if you know what's good for your family and what's good for you. I wasn't strong enough to fight it. You saved Norma's life, and I wanted to do something for you, and that place turned my good wish to its own evil purpose. It has a power, and I think that power goes through phases, same as the moon. It's been full of power before, and I'm scared it's coming around to full again. I'm scared it used me to get at you through your son. Do you see, Lewis, what I'm getting at?
His eyes pleaded with Lewis. You're saying the place knew Gage was going to die, I think, Lewis said.
No, I am saying the place might have made Gage die, because I introduced you to the power in the place. I am saying I may have murdered your son with good intentions, Lewis.
I don't believe it, Lewis said at last, shakily. Didn't. Wouldn't. Couldn't. He held Judd's hand tightly. We're burying Gage tomorrow, in Bangor. And in Bangor he will stay. I don't plan to go up there to the pet cemetery or beyond it ever again.
Promise me, Judd said harshly. Promise.
I promise, Lewis said. But in the back of his mind, contemplation remained. A dancing flicker of promise that would not quite go away.
40. But none of those things happened. All of them. The droning Orenco truck. The fingers that just touched the back of Gage's jumper and then slid off. Rachel preparing to go to the viewing in her housecoat. Ellie carrying Gage's picture and putting his chair next to her bed. Steve Masterton's tears, the fight with Irwin Goldman, Judd Crandall's terrible story of Timmy Baderman, all of them existed only in Lewis Creed's mind during the few seconds that passed while he raced his laughing son to the road. Behind him, Rachel screamed again,
"Gage, come back! Don't run!"
But Lewis did not waste his breath. It was going to be close, very close, and yes, one of those things really happened. From somewhere up the road he could hear the drone of the oncoming truck, and somewhere inside a memory circuit opened,
and he could hear Judd Crandall speaking to Rachel on that very first day in Ludlow.
"You want to watch him around the rut, Mrs. Creed. It's a bad rut for kids and pets."
Now Gage was running down the gentle slope of lawn that merged with the soft shoulder of Route 15, his husky little legs pumping, and by all the rights of the world he should have fallen over sprawling, but he just kept going. And now the sound of the truck was very loud indeed. It was that low, snoring sound that Lewis sometimes heard from his bed as he floated just beyond the rim of sleep. Then it seemed a comforting sound, but now it terrified him. "Oh, my dear God, oh, my dear Jesus, let me catch him. Don't let him get into the road." Lewis put on a final burst of speed and leaped, throwing himself out straight and parallel to the ground like a football player about to make a tackle. He could see his shadow tracking along the grass below him in the lowest periphery of his vision, and he thought of the kite, the vulture, printing its shadow all the way across Mrs. Vinton's field, and just as Gage's forward motion carried him into the road, Lewis's fingers brushed the back of his jacket, and then snagged it. He yanked Gage backward and landed on the ground at the same instant, crashing his face into the rough gravel of the shoulder, giving himself a bloody nose. His balls signaled a much more serious flash of pain.
"Oh, if I'd have known I was going to be playing football, I would have worn my jock."
But both the pain in his nose and the driving agony in his testes were lost in the swelling relief of hearing Gage's wail of pain and outrage as his bottom landed on the shoulder and he fell over backward onto the edge of the lawn, thumping his head. A moment later, his wails were drowned by the roar of the passing truck and the almost regal blat of its air horn. Lewis managed to get up in spite of the lead ball sitting in his lower stomach and cradled his son in his arms. A moment later, Rachel joined them, also weeping, crying out to Gage.
"Never run in the road, Gage! Never, never, never! The road is bad! Bad!"
And Gage was so astonished at this tearful lecture that he left off crying and goggled up at his mother. "Lewis, your nose is bleeding," she said, and then hugged him so suddenly and strongly that for a moment he could barely breathe.
"That isn't the worst of it," he said. "I think I'm sterile, Rachel." "Oh, boy, the pain!"
And she laughed so hysterically that for a few moments he was frightened for her, and the thought crossed his mind, if Gage really had been killed, I believe it would have driven her crazy. But Gage was not killed. All of that had only been a hellishly detailed moment of imagination as Lewis outraced his son's death across a green lawn on a sunshiny May afternoon. Gage went to grammar school, and at the age of 7, he began going to camp, where he showed a wonderful and surprising aptitude for swimming. He also gave his parents a rather glum surprise by proving himself able to handle a month's separation with no noticeable psychic trauma. By the time he was 10, he was spending the entire summer away at Camp Agawam in Raymond, and at 11, he won 2 blue ribbons and a red one at the 4-camp swimathon that ended the summer's activities. He grew tall, and yet through it all, he was the same Gage, sweet, and rather surprised at the things the world held out. And for Gage, the fruit was somehow never bitter or rotten. He was an honor student in high school and a member of the swimming team at John Baptist, the parochial school he had insisted on attending because of its swimming facilities. Rachel was upset, but Lewis was not particularly surprised when, at 17, Gage announced his intention to convert to Catholicism. Rachel believed that all of it was because of the girl Gage was going out with. She saw marriage in his immediate future.
"If that little slut with the St. Christopher's medal isn't bawling him, I'll eat your shorts, Lewis," she said.
The wreckage of his college plans and his Olympic hopes, and 9 or 10 little Catholics running around by the time Gage was 40. By then he would be, according to Rachel anyway, a cigar-smoking truck driver with a beer belly, our-fathering and hail-marrying his way into pre-cardiac oblivion. Lewis suspected his son's motives were rather more pure, and although Gage converted, and on the day he actually did the deed, Lewis sent an unabashedly nasty postcard to Irwin Goldman. It read, "Perhaps you'll have a Jesuit grandson yet. Your goy son-in-law, Lewis." He did not marry the rather nice and decidedly unslutty girl he had dated through most of his senior year. He went on to Johns Hopkins, made the Olympic swimming team, and on one long, dazzling, and incredibly proud afternoon, 16 years after Lewis had raced on a Renko truck for his son's life, he and Rachel, who had now gone almost entirely gray, although she covered it with a rinse, watched their son win a gold medal for the USA. When the NBC cameras moved in for a close-up of him, standing with his dripping, seal-sleek head back, his eyes open and calm and fixed on the flag as the national anthem played, the ribbon around his neck, and the gold lying against the smooth skin of his chest, Lewis wept. He and Rachel both wept. "I guess this caps everything," he said huskily, and turned to embrace his wife. But she was looking at him with a dawning horror, her face seeming to age before his eyes, as if whipped by days and months and years of evil time. The sound of the national anthem faded, and when Lewis looked back at the TV, he saw a different boy there, a black boy with a head of tight curls in which gems of water still gleamed. "This caps everything. His cap. His cap is... oh, dear God, his cap is full of blood." Lewis woke up in the cold, dead light of a rainy 7 o'clock, clutching his pillow in his arms. His head thumped monstrously with his heartbeat. The ache swelled and faded. Swelled and faded. He burped acid that tasted like old beer, and his stomach heaved miserably. He had been weeping. The pillow was wet with his tears, as if he had somehow stumbled in and then out of one of those hokey country and western laments in his sleep. Even in the dream, he thought, some part of him had known the truth, and had cried for it. He got up and stumbled to the bathroom, heart racing threadily in his chest, consciousness itself fragmented by the fierceness of his hangover. He reached the toilet bowl barely in time, and threw up a glut of last night's beer. He kneeled on the floor, eyes closed, until he felt capable of actually making it to his feet. He groped for the handle and flushed the John. He went to the mirror to see how badly bloodshot his eyes were, but the glass had been covered with a square of sheeting. Then he recalled, drawing almost randomly on a past she professed to barely remember, Rachel had covered all the mirrors in the house, and she took off her shoes before entering through the door. No Olympic swimming team, Lewis thought dully as he walked back to his bed and sat down on it. The sour taste of beer coated his mouth and throat, and he swore to himself, not for the first time or the last, that he would never touch that poison again. No Olympic swimming team, no 3.0 in college, no little Catholic girlfriend or conversion, no Camp Agawam, no nothing. His sneakers had been torn off, his jumper turned inside out, his sweet little boy's body, so tough and sturdy, nearly dismembered. His cap had been full of blood. Now, sitting on his bed in the grip of this numbing hangover, rainwater spilling its lazy courses down the window beside him, his grief came for him fully, like some gray matron from Ward 9 in Purgatory. It came and dissolved him, unmanned him, took away whatever defenses remained, and he put his face in his hands and cried, rocking back and forth on his bed, thinking he would do anything to have a second chance. Anything at all. 41. Gage was buried at 2 o'clock that afternoon. By then the rain had stopped. Tattered clouds still moved overhead, and most of the mourners arrived carrying black umbrellas provided by the undertaker. At Rachel's request, the funeral director, who officiated at the short, non-sectarian graveside service, read the passage from Matthew which begins, "Suffer the little children to come unto me." Lewis, standing on one side of the grave, looked across at his father-in-law. For a moment, Goldman looked back at him, and then he dropped his eyes. There was no fight left in him today. The pouches under his eyes now resembled mailbags, and around his black silk skullcap, hair as fine and white as tattered spider webs flew randomly in the breeze. With his grayish-black beard scragging his cheeks, he looked more like a wino than ever. He gave Lewis the impression of a man who did not really know where he was. Lewis tried, but could still find no pity in his heart for him. Gage's small white coffin, its latch presumably repaired, sat on a pair of chromed runners over the grave liner. The verges of the grave had been carpeted with astroturf so violently green it hurt Lewis's eyes. Several baskets of flowers had been set on top of this artificial and strangely gay surface. Lewis's eyes looked over the funeral director's shoulder. Here was a low hill, covered with graves, family plots, one Romanesque monument with the name Phipps engraved on it. Just above the sloping roof of Phipps, he could see a sliver of yellow. Lewis looked at this, pondering it. He continued to look at it, even after the funeral director said, "Let us bow our heads for a moment of silent prayer." It took Lewis a few minutes, but he got it. It was a payloader. A payloader parked over the hill where the mourners wouldn't have to look at it. And when the funeral was over, Oz would crush his cigarette on the heel of his terrible work boot, put it in whatever container he carried around with him. In a cemetery, sextons caught depositing their butts on the ground were almost always summarily fired. It looked bad. Too many of the clientele had died of lung cancer. Jump in the payloader, fire that sucker up, and cut his son off from the sun forever. Or at least until the day of the resurrection.
Resurrection. Ah, there's a word. That you should put right the fuck out of your mind and you know it.
When the funeral director said amen, Lewis took Rachel's arm and guided her away. Rachel murmured some protest. She wanted to stay a bit longer, please, Lewis. But Lewis was firm. They approached the cars. He saw the funeral director taking umbrellas with the home's name discreetly printed on the handles from the mourners who passed and handing them to an assistant. The assistant put them in an umbrella stand which looked surreal, standing there on the dewy turf. He held Rachel's arm with his right hand and Ellie's white-gloved hand with his left. Ellie was wearing the same dress she had worn to Norma Crandall's funeral. Judd came over as Lewis handed his ladies into the car. Judd also looked as if he'd had a hard night.
"You okay, Lewis?"
Lewis nodded. Judd bent to look into the car.
"How are you, Rachel?" he asked.
"I'm all right, Judd,"
she whispered. Judd touched her shoulder gently and then looked at Ellie.
"How about you, dear one?"
"I'm fine,"
Ellie said, and produced a hideous smile of shark-like proportions to show him how fine she was.
"What's that picture you got there?"
For a moment, Lewis thought she would hold it, refused to show him, and then with a painful shyness she passed it to Judd. He held it in his big fingers, fingers that were so splayed and somehow clumsy-looking, fingers that looked fit mostly for grappling with the transmissions of big road machines or making couplings on the B&M line, but they were also the fingers that had pulled a bee stinger from Gage's neck with all the offhand skill of a magician or a surgeon.
"Why, that's real nice," Judd said. "You pullin' him on a sled. Bet he liked that, didn't he, Ellie?"
Beginning to weep, Ellie nodded. Rachel began to say something, but Lewis squeezed her arm.
"Be still a while."
"I used to pull him a lot,"
Ellie said, weeping.
"And he'd laugh and laugh. Then we'd go in and Mommy would fix us cocoa and say, 'Put your boots away.' And Gage would grab them all up and scream, 'Boots, boots,' so loud it hurt your ears. Remember that, Mom?"
Rachel nodded.
I bet that was a good time, all right," Judd said, handing the picture back. "And he may be dead now, Ellie, but you can keep your memories of him.
I'm going to, she said, wiping at her face. I loved Gage, Mr. Crandall.
I know you did, dear. He leaned in and kissed her, and when he withdrew, his eyes swept Lewis and Rachel stonily. Rachel met his gaze, puzzled and a little hurt, not understanding, but Lewis understood well enough.
What are you doing for her? Judd's eyes asked. Your son is dead, but your daughter is not. What are you doing for her?
Lewis looked away. There was nothing he could do for her. Not yet. She would have to swim in her grief as best she could. His thoughts were too full of his son.
42. By evening, a fresh rack of clouds had come in and a strong west wind had begun to blow. Lewis put on his light jacket, zipped it up, and took the civic keys from the peg on the wall.
Where are you going, Lou? Rachel asked.
She spoke without much interest. After supper, she had begun crying again, and although her weeping was gentle, she had seemed incapable of stopping. Lewis had forced her to take a Valium. Now she sat with the paper folded open to the barely started crossword puzzle. In the other room, Ellie sat silently watching Little House on the Prairie with Gage's picture on her lap.
I thought I'd pick up a pizza.
Didn't you get enough to eat earlier?
I just didn't seem hungry then, he said, telling the truth and then adding a lie. I am now.
That afternoon, between 3 and 6, the final rite of Gage's funeral had taken place at the Ludlow house. This was the rite of food. Steve Masterton and his wife had come with a hamburger and noodle casserole. Charlton had appeared with a quiche.
It will keep until you want it if it doesn't all get eaten, she told Rachel. Quiche is easy to warm up.
The Danekers from up the road brought a baked ham. The Goldmans appeared. Neither of them would speak to Lewis or even come close to him, for which he was not sorry, with a variety of cold cuts and cheeses. Judd also brought cheese, a large wheel of his old favorite, Mr. Rat. Missy Dandridge brought a key lime pie, and Surendra Hardu brought apples. The rite of food apparently transcended religious differences. This was the funeral party, and although it was quiet, it was not quite subdued. There was rather less drinking than at an ordinary party, but there was some. After a few beers, only the night before he had sworn he would never touch the stuff again, but in the cold afternoon light the previous evening it seemed impossibly long ago. Lewis thought to pass on a few little funerary anecdotes his Uncle Carl had told him. That at Sicilian funerals, unmarried women sometimes snipped a piece of the deceased's shroud and slept with it under their pillows, believing it would bring them luck and love. That at Irish funerals, mock weddings were sometimes performed, and the toes of the dead were tied together because of an ancient Celtic belief that it kept the deceased's ghost from walking. Uncle Carl said that the custom of tying DOA tags to the great toes of corpses had begun in New York, and since all of the early morgue keepers had been Irish, he believed this to be a survival of that old superstition. Then, looking at their faces, he had decided such tales would be taken wrong. Rachel had broken down only once, and her mother was there to comfort her. Rachel clung to Dory Goldman and sobbed against her shoulder in an open, let-it-all-go way that had been so far impossible for her with Lewis, perhaps because she saw them both as culpable in Gage's death, or perhaps because Lewis, lost in the peculiar half-world of his own fancies, had not encouraged her grief. Either way, she had turned to her mother for comfort, and Dory was there to give it, mingling her tears with her daughter's. Erwin Goldman stood behind them, his hand on Rachel's shoulder, and looked with sickly triumph across the room at Lewis. Ellie circulated with a silver tray loaded with canapés, little rolls with a feathered toothpick poked through each one. Her picture of Gage was tucked firmly under her arm. Lewis received condolences. He nodded and thanked the condolers, and if his eyes seemed distant, his manner a little cold, people supposed he was thinking of the past, of the accident, of the gageless life ahead. None, perhaps not even Judd, would have suspected that Lewis had begun to think about the strategies of grave robbing, only in an academic way, of course. It was not that he intended to do anything. It was only a way to keep his mind occupied. It was not as if he intended to do anything. Lewis stopped at the Orrington corner store, bought 2 6-packs of cold beer, and called ahead to Napoli's for a pepperoni and mushroom pizza.
"Want to give me a name on that, sir?"
Oz the Great and Terrible, Lewis thought. Lou Creed.
"Okay, Lou, we're real busy, so it'll maybe be 45 minutes. That okay for you?"
"Sure," Lewis said and hung up. As he got back into the Civic and keyed the engine, it occurred to him that although there were maybe 20 pizza joints in the Bangor area, he had picked the one closest to Pleasant View, where Gage was buried. "Well, what the hell?" he thought uneasily. "They make good pizza. No frozen dough. Throw it up and catch it on their fists, right there where you can watch. And Gage used to laugh." He cut that thought off. He drove past Napoli's to Pleasant View. He supposed he had known that he would do that. But what harm? None. He parked across the street and crossed the road to the wrought iron gates, which glimmered in the final light of day. Above them, in a semicircle, were wrought iron letters spelling Pleasant View. The view was, in Lewis's mind, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. The cemetery was nicely landscaped on several rolling hills. There were long aisles of trees. Ah, but in these last few minutes of fading daylight, the shadows those trees threw seemed deeply pooled and as blackly unpleasant as still quarry water, and a few isolated weeping willows. It wasn't quiet. The turnpike was near. The drone of traffic came on the steady, chill wind, and the glow in the darkening sky was Bangor International Airport. He stretched his hand out to the gate, thinking, "They'll be locked." But they were not. Perhaps it was too early to lock them, and if they locked them at all, it would only be to protect the place against drunks, vandals, and teenage neckers. The days of the Dickensian resurrection men, there's that word again, were over. The right-hand gate swung in with a faint screeing noise, and after a glance over his shoulder to make sure he was unobserved, Lewis stepped through. He closed the gate behind him and heard the click of the latch. He stood in this modest suburb of the dead, looking around. "A fine and private place," he thought, "but none, I think, do there embrace. Who? Andrew Marvell? And why did the human mind store up such amazing middens of useless junk, anyway?" Judd's voice spoke up in his mind then, worried and frightened. "Yes, frightened."
"Lewis, what are you doing here? You're looking up a road you don't want to travel."
He pushed the voice aside. If he was torturing anyone, it was only himself. No one need know he had been here as the daylight wound down to the dark. He began to walk toward Gage's grave, taking one of the winding paths. In a moment he was in a lane of trees. They rustled their new leaves mysteriously over his head. His heart was thudding too loudly in his chest. The graves and monuments were in rough rows. Somewhere there would be a caretaker's building, and in it would be a map of Pleasant View's 20 or so acres, neatly and sanely divided into quadrants, each quadrant showing the occupied graves and the unsold plots. Real estate for sale. One-room apartments. Sleepers. Not much like the pet cemetery, he thought, and this caused him to stop and consider for a moment, surprised. No, it wasn't. The pet cemetery had given him an impression of order rising almost unknown out of chaos. Those rough concentric circles moving inward to the center. Rude slates. Crosses made out of boards. As if the children who buried their pets there had created the pattern out of their own collective unconsciousness. As if... For a moment, Lewis saw the pet cemetery as a kind of advertisement. A come-on.
like the kind they give you on Freak Alley at the carnival. They'd bring out the fire eater and you got to watch his show for free because the owners knew you wouldn't buy the steak unless you saw the sizzle. You wouldn't cough up the cash if you didn't see the flash. Those graves in their almost druidic circles. The graves in the pet cemetery mimed the most ancient religious symbol of all, diminishing circles indicating a spiral leading down, not to a point, but to infinity. Order from chaos or chaos from order, depending on which way your mind worked. It was a symbol the Egyptians had chiseled on the tombs of the pharaohs, a symbol the Phoenicians had drawn on the barrows of their fallen kings. It was found on cave walls in ancient Mycenae. The guild kings of Stonehenge had created it as a clock to time the universe. It appeared in the Judeo-Christian Bible as the whirlwind from which God had spoken to Job. The spiral was the oldest sign of power in the world, man's oldest symbol of that twisty bridge which may exist between the world and the gulf. Lewis reached Gage's grave at last. The payloader was gone. The astroturf had been removed, rolled up by some whistling workman with his mind on an after-work beer at the Fairmont Lounge, stored in an equipment shed somewhere. Where Gage lay, there was a neat rectangle of bare, raked earth, perhaps 5 feet by 3 feet. The headstone had not been set up yet. Lewis kneeled. The wind blew through his hair, tumbling it. The sky was almost entirely dark now. It raced with clouds. No one has shown a light in my face and asked me what I'm doing here. No watchdog has barked. The gate was unlocked. The days of the resurrection man are past. If I came up here with a pick and a shovel, he came back to himself with a jerk. He was only playing a dangerous mind game with himself if he pretended that Pleasant View stood unwatched during the night hours. Suppose he was discovered, belly deep in his son's new grave, by the caretaker or the watchman. It might not get into the papers, but then again, it might. He might be charged with a crime. What crime? Grave robbing? Unlikely. Malicious mischief or vandalism would be more likely. And in the paper or out of it, the word would get around. People would talk. It was a story too juicy not to be told. Local doctor is discovered digging up his 2-year-old son, recently killed in a tragic road accident. He would lose his job. Even if not, Rachel would be chilled by the wind of such tales, and Ellie might be harried by them at school until her life was a misery of chanting children. There might be the humiliation of a sanity test in exchange for dropping charges. But I could bring Gage back to life. Gage could live again. Did he really, actually, believe that? The fact was that he did. He had told himself time and time again, both before Gage's death and after it, that Church had not really been dead, only stunned. That Church had dug his way out and come home. A kiddie story with gruesome undertones. Winnie the Pooh. Master unwittingly piles a cairn of stones over a living animal. Faithful beast digs itself out and comes home. Fine. Except it was not true. Church had been dead. The Micmac burying ground had brought it back to life. He sat by Gage's grave, trying to place all the known components in an order as rational and logical as this dark magic would allow. Timmy Baderman now. First, did he believe the story? And second, did it make a difference? In spite of its convenience, he believed most of it. It was undeniable that if a place like the Micmac burying ground existed, as it did, and if people knew of it, as a few of the older Ludlowites did, then sooner or later someone would try the experiment. Human nature, as Lewis understood it, made it more difficult to believe that it had stopped at a few pets and valuable breed animals. All right, then. Did he also believe that Timmy Baderman had been transformed into some sort of all-knowing demon? That was a more difficult question, and he was wary of it, because he didn't want to believe it, and he had seen the results of that sort of mindset before.
No, he did not want to believe Timmy Baderman had been a demon, but he would not, absolutely could not, allow himself to let what he wanted cloud his judgment. Lewis thought about Hanratty, the bull. Hanratty, Judd said, had turned mean. So in his way had Timmy Baderman. Hanratty had later been put down by the same man who had somehow dragged the bull's body up to the Micmac burying ground on a sledge. Timmy Baderman had been put down by his father. But because Hanratty had gone bad, did that mean that all animals went bad? No. Hanratty the bull did not prove the general case. Hanratty was in fact an exception to the general case. Look back at the other animals. Judd's dog Spot, the old woman's parakeet, Church himself. They had all come back changed, and the change had been noticeable in all cases, but in the case of Spot, at least, the change hadn't been so great that Judd had forborne to recommend the process of resurrection. Yes, of resurrection, to a friend, years later. Of course, farther down the line, he had tried to justify and hem and haw, and had spouted a lot of ominous, confused bullshit that could not even rightly be called philosophy. How could he refuse to take the chance available to him? This one, unbelievable chance, on the basis of the Timmy Baderman story. One swallow did not a summer make. You're slanting all the evidence in favor of the conclusion you want to produce, his mind protested. At least tell yourself the goddamn truth about the change in Church. Even if you want to disqualify the animals, the mice and the birds, what about the way he is? Muddled. That's the best word of all. That sums it up. The day we were out with the kite. You remember how Gage was that day? How vibrant and alive he was, reacting to everything? Wouldn't it be better to remember him that way? Do you want to resurrect a zombie from a grade B horror picture? Or even something so prosaic as a retarded little boy? A boy who eats with his fingers and stares blankly at images on the TV screen? And who will never learn to write his own name? What did Judd say about his dog? It was like washing a piece of meat. Is that what you want? A piece of breathing meat? And even if you're able to be satisfied with that, how do you explain the return of your son from the dead to your wife, to your daughter, to Steve Masterton, to the world? What happens the first time Missy Dandridge pulls into the driveway and sees Gage riding his trike in the yard? Can't you hear her screams, Lewis? Can't you see her harrowing her face with her fingernails? What do you say to the reporters? What do you say when a film crew from Real People turns up on your doorstep, wanting to shoot film of your resurrected son? Did any of this really matter, or was it only the voice of cowardice? Did he believe these things could not be dealt with? That Rachel would greet her dead son with anything but tears of joy? Yes, he supposed there was a real possibility that Gage might return, well, diminished. But would that change the quality of his love? Parents loved children who were born blind, children born as Siamese twins, children who were born with their guts abysmally rearranged. Parents pled for judicial mercy or executive clemency on behalf of children who had grown up to commit rape and murder and the torture of the innocent. Did he believe it would be impossible for him to love Gage, even if Gage had to go on wearing diapers until he was 8? If he did not master the first grade primer until he was 12? If he never mastered it at all? Could he simply dismiss his son as a sort of divine abortion when there was another recourse? But Lewis, my God, you don't live in a vacuum. People will say, he cut that thought off with rude, angry force. Of all the things not to consider now, public notice was probably the greatest of them. Lewis glanced down at the raked dirt of Gage's grave and felt a wave of awe and horror course through him. Unknowing, moving by themselves, his fingers had drawn a pattern in the dirt. He had drawn a spiral. He swept the fingers of both hands through the dirt, rubbing the pattern out. Then he left Pleasant View, hurrying, feeling very much a trespasser now, believing that he would be seen, stopped, questioned at every turn of the path. He was late collecting his pizza, and although it had been left on top of one of the big ovens, it was semi-cold and greasy, and every bit as tasty as cooked clay. Lewis ate one piece and then tossed the rest out the window, box and all, as he headed back to Ludlow. He wasn't a litter bug by nature, but he did not want Rachel to see a mostly uneaten pizza at home in the wastebasket. It might raise a surmise in her mind that a pizza wasn't really what he'd had in mind when he went to Bangor. Lewis now began to think about the time and circumstance. Time. Time might be of extreme, even crucial importance. Timmy Baderman had been dead a good while before his father could get him up to the Micmac burying ground.
Timmy was shot the 19th. Timmy was buried. Don't hold me to this, but I think it was on July 22nd. It was 4 or 5 days later that Marjorie Washburn saw Timmy walking up the Rudd.
All right. Say that Bill Baderman had done it 4 days after his son's original interral. No. If he was going to err, let him err on the side of conservatism. Say 3 days. For the sake of argument, assume that Timmy Baderman returned from the dead on July 25th. That made 6 days between the boy's death and his return, and that was a conservative estimate. It might have been as long as 10 days. For Gage, it had now been 4 days. Time had already gotten away from him to a degree, but it was still possible to cut Bill Baderman's best time considerably if he could bring about circumstances similar to those which had made the resurrection of Church possible. Because Church had died at the best possible time, hadn't he? His family had been away when Church was struck and killed. No one was the wiser except for him and Judd. His family had been in Chicago. For Lewis, the final piece fell into place with a neat little click.
"You want us to what?" Rachel asked, staring at him, astounded. It was 10:15. Ellie had gone to bed. Rachel had taken another Valium after cleaning up the detritus of the funeral party. Funeral party was another of those horrible phrases full of unstated paradox, like visiting hours. But there seemed no other phrase for the way they had spent their afternoon, and had seemed dazed and quiet ever since he returned from Bangor. But this had gotten through. "To go back to Chicago with your mother and father," Lewis repeated patiently. "They'll be going tomorrow. If you call them now in Delta right after, you may be able to get on the same plane with them."
"Lewis, have you lost your mind? After the fight you had with my father?" Lewis found himself speaking with a quick glibness that was totally unlike him. It afforded him a cheesy sort of exhilaration. He felt like a football sub who suddenly gets the ball and makes a 70-yard touchdown run, cutting and weaving, outthinking potential tacklers with a delirious one-time-only ease. He had never been a particularly good liar, and he had not planned this encounter in any detail at all, but now a string of plausible lies, half-truths, and inspired justification poured out of him. "The fight we had is one of the reasons I want you and Ellie to go back with them. It's time we sewed up this wound, Rachel. I knew that, felt it, at the funeral parlor. When the fight started, I was trying to patch things up."
"But this trip? I don't think it's a good idea at all, Lewis. We need you. And you need us."
Her eyes measured him doubtfully. "At least I hope you need us. And neither of us are in any shape to, in any kind of shape to stay here," Lewis said forcefully. He felt as if he might be coming down with a fever. "I'm glad you need me, and I do need you and Ellie. But right now, this is the worst damn place in the world for you, honey. Gage is everywhere in this house, around every corner. For you and me, sure, but it's even worse for Ellie, I think." He saw a pain flicker in her eyes and knew he had touched her. Some part of himself felt shame at this cheap victory. All the textbooks he'd read on the subject of death told him that the bereaved's first strong impulse is to get away from the place where it happened, and that to succumb to such an impulse may turn out to be the most harmful course of action, because it allows the bereaved the dubious luxury of refusing to come to terms with the new reality. The book said it was best to remain where you were,
to battle grief on its home ground until it subsided into remembrance. But Lewis simply did not dare make the experiment with his family at home. He had to get rid of them, at least for a while.
I know, she said. It just hits you all over the place. I moved the couch while you were in Bangor. I thought running the vacuum around would take my mind off things. And I found four of his little matchbox cars under there, as if they were waiting for him to come back and, you know, play with them.
Her voice, already wavering, now broke. Tears spilled down her cheeks. And that's when I took the second Valium because I started crying again, the way I'm crying now. Oh, what a fucking soap opera all of this is. Hold me, Lou. Will you hold me? He did hold her, and he did it well, but he felt like an imposter. His mind spun with ways to turn these tears to his further benefit.
Some nice guy, all right. Hey-ho, let's go.
How long does it go on? She wept. Does it ever end? If only we could have him back, Lewis, I swear I'd watch him better. It would never happen. And just because that driver was going too fast, that doesn't let me, us, off the hook. I didn't know there could ever be hurt like this, and that's the truth. It comes over and over. It comes, and it hurts so much, Lewis. There's no rest from it, even when I go to sleep. When I go to sleep, I dream it over and over again. I see him running to the road, and I scream to him.
Shh, he said. Rachel, shh. She lifted her puffy face to him.
It wasn't even as if he were being bad, Lewis. It was just a game to him. The truck came along at the wrong time, and Missy Dandridge called while I was still crying. And she said she read in the Ellsworth American that the driver tried to kill himself.
What?
He tried to hang himself in his garage. He's in shock and deep depression, the paper said.
Too fucking bad he didn't make good on it, Lewis said savagely. But his voice sounded distant to his own ears, and he felt a chill spreading through.
The place has a power, Lewis. It's been full of power before, and I'm scared it's coming around full again.
My boy's dead and he's out on $1,000 bail. And he'll go on feeling depressed and suicidal until some judge takes away his license for 90 days and gives him a slap on the wrist fine.
Missy says his wife has taken the kids and left him, Rachel said dully. She didn't get that from the paper, but from somebody who knows somebody down Ellsworth way. He wasn't drunk. He wasn't on drugs. He didn't have any previous speeding violations. He said that when he got to Ludlow, he just felt like putting the pedal to the metal. He said he didn't even know why. So around and around it goes.
He just felt like putting the pedal to the metal. The place has a power. Lewis thrust those thoughts away. He gripped his wife's forearm gently. Call your mother and father. Do it now. There's no need for you and Ellie to be in this house another day. Not another day.
Not without you, she said. Lewis, I need us to stick together.
I'll follow you in 3 days, 4 at the most. If things went well, Rachel and Ellie might be back here in 48 hours. I've got to find someone to fill in for me, on a part-time basis at least, at the university. I've got sick time and vacation time coming, but I don't want to leave Surrendra on the hot seat. Judd can watch the house while we're gone, but I want to cut off the electricity and store what we've got in the Dandridge's deep freeze.
Ellie's school.
The hell with it. It's out in 3 weeks anyway. They'll understand the circumstances being what they are. They'll arrange an early dismissal. It'll all work just, Lewis? He broke off.
What? What are you hiding?
Hiding? He looked at her openly, clearly.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Don't you?
No, I don't. Never mind. I'll call them right now, if that's what you really want.
It is, he said, and the words seemed to echo in his mind with an iron clang.
It might even be best for Ellie.
She looked at him with her red-rimmed eyes, still slightly glazed from Valium.
You look feverish, Lewis, as if you might be coming down with something.
She went to the telephone and called the motel where her parents were staying before Lewis could reply. The Goldmans were overjoyed at Rachel's proposal.